Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Well, we take a long walk down memory lane with lots of interesting K-Rock talk back in the day. And Pete Holmes, the super funny Pete Holmes, joins us as well. So we got that to look forward in the first half.
Back inside the toolbox where our hearts start to beat a little faster in anticipation of the end of the California lockdowns. To my fellow 2 million-plus doomsayers and naysayers, we got a real chance to get rid of Gavin Newsom's. But who's going to replace him? I got a dirty sponge under my sink that's up for the job. Let's open up the Van Halen vault because I'm feeling the love. And when it comes to love and Van Halen, Diamond Dave ain't talking about it. But Sammy likes to ponder the finer points, so here's Van Hagar on the toolbox. Wow! From Carolla One Studios in Glendale, California, this is the Adam Carolla Show. Adam's guest today, Pete Holmes. With Gina Grad on news, Bald Brian on sound effects, and a spirited round of the Rotten Tomatoes game. And now, last night he set his clock forward 7 months to the day we fall back so he can sleep in. Adam Carolla.
Yeah, get it on. Got to get it on. No choice. We're going to mandate you get it on. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for telling a friend. We love that about you, right, Gina Grad?
That's right.
Handball, Brian.
I fuck your daughter.
Peter.
Pete, please.
Peter Holmes is going to be joining us. Pete Holmes, one of our favorites, is going to be joining us. Just a good dude. So excited and funny. So I talked to Pete Holmes coming up. We got Rotten Tomatoes coming as well. I've been getting some tweets about this Hulu doc, Kid 90. And someone, a few tweets, it said it's got Mr. Burcham in it.
Oh, wow.
I didn't see it, but Max Zapata dutifully went and found it. And then we're trying to kind of figure it out. Is it Mr. Burcham? Is it me? I've realized a lot of these old clips from the radio are compressed weird and voice sounds higher. So it didn't initially sound to me like Mr. Burcham, but then it said Lightning was the engineer, and it was at K-Rock, and it was daytime, and you could see out the window of the old K-Rock Daltz building, we used to call it, in Burbank. So then I thought, well, now it must be Burcham, and it's daytime, or at least it's morning time. And I think I've solved the riddle, because I did Burcham with Kevin and Bean, but this wasn't with Kevin and Bean. But I think I figured it out. So we'll play you guys the clip. And then I'll
tell you. You're listening to 106.7 Kara.
Next up, we got Punky Brewster. She's going to discuss candidly her bouts with alcoholism, heroin abuse, and teenage prostitution. Yeah, no. Am I right?
No.
All right, well, pick one of them.
So.
Wow.
That was Mr. Burcham doing his morning time Burcham show. I believe it was Saturdays on K-Rock. I believe it started at 8 or 9. I believe it was like a two-hour show. And it was like 8 to 10 or 9 to 11 on K-Rock Saturday mornings. And I have no idea how long I did that show. I think what happened, maybe Soleil Moonfry, Punky Brewster, was going to be the guest. And she was going to be the guest on Mr. Burcham's Home Improvement show. No idea how that worked. But Lightning was Jay Tillis, was working the board. So he must have agreed to come in on Saturday mornings and do the board for me when I was doing a Mr. Burcham. Hmm. I remember I was living in an apartment in Toluca Lake and nervous because it was like this was my first radio show. I had
solo.
Been,
yeah.
Yeah. I had been doing these spots on Kevin and Bean working up to that. The character got popular enough that they thought, well, give him his own Saturday morning home improvement show. And Lightning was working the boards, who was not the producer of Kevin and Bean at that point. I think he was just the go-get-it guy. I think Frank Murphy was, maybe even Jimmy. I don't know. I think Jimmy produced for a couple of years. And then that was the show that Dr. Drew used to listen to pretty religiously when he would go on his jogs on a Saturday morning, probably with his Walkman radio or something. And that's about the time, the way I got from that job to hosting Loveline was they then went to Drew and they said, who would you like to host Loveline with you? And he was like, the Mr. Burcham guy's funny. I don't know who the guy is. I don't know his name. I don't know if it's an act, but the Burcham guy is a funny guy.
Wow.
So
if Drew could go back and tap himself on the shoulder now.
Oh, my God. He would have said, stay the course with Ricky Rackman.
Poor man is the man.
Poor man had probably been gone for 3 years at that point, and Ricky Rackman from Headbangers Ball had taken over. It's kind of an interesting thing, I guess, if you look at my trajectory and you look at Ricky Rackman's trajectory as well, which is I was a carpenter who got a job at a boxing place using his carpentry to let me try to teach boxing, who then parlayed the boxing thing into meeting Jimmy, who parlayed meeting Jimmy into sort of getting on with Mr. Burcham on K-Rock, who then went from doing Burcham on K-Rock to doing Burcham on a Saturday morning show, which then led to Drew hearing it, and then which led to Loveline. The TV show, I think, on MTV first, weirdly, and then that gave way to Loveline, the syndicated radio show. Ricky Rackman wasn't a radio guy, and he didn't have a big broadcasting history. Ricky Rackman ran, what was his club? He had a club in West L.A.
Oh.
Before my time.
Yeah.
And it was called, it's like Rodney on the Rock had a club, the
really?
New England or some of the New English or the new whatever.
He Cat had, House?
Cat House. So Ricky ran.
Where was it?
Cat House in the probably late 80s, early 90s. And Ricky, and I'm sure I'm screwing up this story, but he was in with all the Guns N' Roses and all the different rock acts and stuff who would play the Cat House. So then I think Ricky's thing with MTV was, I may not be a VJ and I may not have a bunch of reps hosting a show or radio or anything, but if you give me a show, I will get Axl Rose in here because I know Axl Rose.
Right. I got a Rolodex.
I got a Rolodex with all these different sort of hair bands from the 80s and 90s, and I will get them, and I will interview these guys, and then you will have a show called Headbangers Ball. And then parlayed the MTV stuff into the K-Rock stuff and the Loveline
Smart,
stuff.
Smart, honestly.
Yeah, yeah, but they're both good stories of... I may not be the person you think you want, but I do have these other connections. I have
something else to offer.
I have another skill. I have something else to offer. And you should take a chance on me because I will then bring these other things in that you want, which is a good... Most people don't want no experience, you know, meets, never done this before, but... If you then start laying out other stuff that you do, like another skill set, here's what I could do, they will take a chance on you, because at that point they're not taking a chance, because they get to get Axl Rose on their network, or in this particular case, for me, Bruce gets to get his heavy bags hung and his speed bags hung and his gym built out, and then they're much more willing to take a chance. And
Bean gets to put some shelving units put in.
Yeah, Bean. I went to Bean's house and built. Well, I built a CD rack that held 10,000 CDs.
Even better.
Yeah, the good news about CDs, they're small-ish compared to what we used to deal with. And I remember just building them, these racks that went like floor to ceiling all the way down one wall and all the way down the other. And then Bean had his like, Bean had like 2,000 Christmas CDs to put in there.
We got to theme them.
Yeah, I don't know. It's kind of weird. I guess we could all say, here's what we like. Like, I like cars, and Gina likes cooking. Brian likes his wife's paycheck. You know, we all have our hobbies, right?
Sure. Things we enjoy. Our passions.
Right. But 10,000 CDs is a little different than I like cooking or I like cars. I feel like there's something more to that. But anyway.
According to the LA Weekly, this article from 4 or so 5 years ago, the venue initially opened on September 23rd, 86. And that was to the corner of La Cienega and San Vicente, which is sort of just on the fringe of Hollywood there.
Wow. Yeah,
that's a weird place for it to be. I looked and I thought it was like Highland and Melrose, but maybe there's two spots.
Yeah.
Maybe it moved.
Probably moved.
That's right there. The scene is happening there. So, yeah. And I don't know. Look, every club is going to fail. I mean, clubs just
dare
fail.
Dare to dream.
No, true.
Yeah, they're all going to fail, but you'll get a couple of old pictures of you standing there with David Bowie with crazy hair, or Axl Rose, or whoever came through your club. I was thinking with Rodney Bingenheimer. Was it the King of the Sunset Strip? Was that it, Brian?
Fantastic documentary,
because it had all the pathos and all the stuff, all the highs and the lows in it. But yeah, Rodney had that club, and he had like David Bowie and Mick Jagger and all that. It's kind of interesting that that's kind of a rich man, poor man thing, which is at some point, whether you're a comedian or a music act, when you get big enough, you just play stadiums and little miniature fucked up clubs. No, gone are the days with the 1,200 seat theaters.
Right. No Civic Center. No Pacific Art Center.
I'm looking at the Cat House Hollywood website, and literally I had just read the line where apparently Guns N' Roses played the 700 person club the night before they played the 150,000 people at the Coliseum.
Really?
So I literally just read that. I'm looking at it right now.
Yeah. It's the medium. It's the middle that always takes the beating. It's not, you know, I don't know. It's like the 5-star Michelin rated thing, and then the cool, trendy taco truck that seems to get all the love. The in-betweeners don't really. We're as a society, we're just not really interested in the middle. We don't like that.
No one has time for CPK.
Right. We got the story, and the story is playing the Megadome or playing the Honky Tonk. But either way, Ricky went and did that, and then Ricky did Loveline, and then I did Loveline with Ricky, and that was uncomfortable for, felt like a long time, but it's really only like 3 months, and then Ricky moved on, and then it was just me and Drew, but the old guard, I think, kind of liked Ricky at that show. It's also, as I've said, it's kind of interesting. Everyone loved Poor Man, and then Poor Man left, and then everyone didn't want anyone to replace Poor Man, and then Ricky came in, and then everyone hated on Ricky, and then they got used to Ricky, and then Ricky left, and everyone hated on me. So it's kind of a Kuna Matata. It's a little
familiar
circle.
I'm familiar.
Yeah,
it's a good thing that stopped then.
You know, the two things that reminds me of is A, when I think of poor man, all I think of are like late night, like in paid programming commercials where he's on the beach with like bikini clad, you know, just chicks running around Venice Beach. Mm-hmm. You remember that? Like,
yeah, it was yeah, poor man's beach party. Night. They were like infomercial type.
They were like Girls Gone Wild.
Yeah, like a 90-second ad or something.
Yes, that
you could buy your own airtime like in the middle of the night or something. I think that
was
it.
Pay to play. And when you talk about Ricky, was this before or after he punched Steckler?
Oh, I forgot.
Or was that the other way around? Now I'm confusing myself. I'm getting old. I'm confusing myself.
Steckler, Doug Steckler.
Yeah.
Was with Tim Conway Jr. for all those years. I used to always come in and do their show on the way into doing Loveline. They were probably on from 7 to 10 or something like that on KLSX.
Yeah, 8 to 11, I think, yeah.
8 to, 8 to 11. I used to be able to drop by at 8:15 and sit in for an hour, and then I'd have to get up and hustle it out to Loveline. But it was sort of on the way, Koreatown, Wilshire. And then I was heading to Culver City, but it was kind of leaving Hollywood Hills. But then Steckler, who was not a young man at the time, Doug Steckler, and a comedian, or a satirist.
A writer.
A writer, yeah. Satirist.
Humorist.
Yeah.
He wrote for SETV, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. He was kind of... kind of Will Rogers-y, wasn't really a stand-up, but wasn't really a pure writer, but could deliver the stuff, but was sort of a satirist. He walked out of the studio and got cold-cocked by Ricky Rackman, because I think that happened at KLSX.
Yeah, it did.
And I think what happened was, after Ricky left Loveline, he got snatched up by KLSX. And started doing the show maybe after Conway and Steckler on KLSX, and they were making fun of him, and he came out or he came in and punched him in the face. There's a lot of that kind of stuff. It was a bygone era because I remember when Booger Man choked Jimmy for talking about his penis enlargement on the air. I remember when David Arquette showed up at my studio when I was calling him nuts. You know, the thing about, if you're doing I was thinking about LeVar Burton calling me once at my desk because I did a movie Men Don't Want to See, and LeVar Burton was one of the characters that was in it with Dick Van Patten or something. Max Bata, you might be able to find... movies Men Don't Want to See. It was a man show bit.
Yeah, I think we've played this one.
We have. I used to write quite a few of them. And this was one about a gay couple on the frontier. And for some reason, I had LeVar Burton in there. And LeVar Burton called me at my desk and wanted to know why he was in there. And I said, I don't know. It seemed funny. I think he thought I was accusing him of being gay, which I kind of was, but only in the context of this movie that nobody wanted to see. But there were actors playing a frontier gay couple. But is LeVar Burton gay? I don't know. Maybe he was protesting too much, or nobody knows.
You got the jump on Brokeback Mountain then.
You know what, Gina? I'm glad you brought that up because this would have been circa...
It's been alluded to.
It would have been circa 2000. I never thought of it. But yeah, there was a Brokeback Mountain kind of... there were Brokeback Mountain overtones.
Okay. I'm looking up a year of that. Do you know, Brian?
When the movie Brokeback was 04, 03.
I think this was called Frontier Dads, maybe. And maybe Dick Van Patten was the other guy. Dick never called. He didn't want to know what was going on. But what I'm saying is when LeVar Burton called me at my desk in my man show office, it's always funny. I got like the call, like, LeVar Burton's on line 3. I'm like, how do you know it's LeVar Burton? I don't know. He said he was LeVar Burton. It seems like enough. I'm like, okay. It was too late. We'd already done the bit. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. But in radio... you could talk about stuff and it would just go out in real time. So when Booger Man was out driving his van around and he heard Jimmy talking shit. You know, it was going to take him about 20 minutes to turn the van around and get up to the ninth floor of the Daltz building. But Jimmy was going to be there when he got there. And, you know, when Steckler was making fun of Ricky Rackman.
Yeah, right outside the door.
They're right in the same building. You can go find him.
I see an LA Times archived article from September 11th, 1997. KLSX fires talk show host over office scuffle.
Yeah.
Ricky Rackman faces a misdemeanor battery charge for allegedly punching station colleague Doug Steckler at the office Monday, et cetera, et cetera.
Nice.
And that's 97.
September 11th, 97.
Right. So he must have been not too long after he left. He left because I took over in 96 or something like that. It wasn't a scuffle. It's more of like, if you ever see the footage of what happens to the poor Asians in San Francisco when they're walking down the street, a little more of that probably. And a
one-sided.
A little more one-sided. Yeah. And the Booger Man thing, he didn't punch Jimmy. He was just choking him against a wall of Frank Murphy's office, by the way.
I know it's not totally the same, but you got, I guess, invited, for lack of a better way to put it, to Poo Poo City on the air.
Yeah, Fletcher from Pennywise locked us in the studio. Had the five or six members of the police of the Culver City policemen there. They kind of knew us. I think they showed up, but there wasn't much they could do. They were locked out.
What else was there to do at that point in Culver City at that time of night?
Yeah. Oh, there was nothing to do at Culver City in that time of night. I knew it well because every once in a while when I walked out in the parking lot at 12:05 and it was climbing into my BMW M3, there'd be a squad car sitting there.
Just hanging out.
Hanging out. And the guys be like, "You want to go?" I'd be like, "Yeah." And we'd pull out to like Washington or Culver Boulevard or whatever, and we'd just sit at the red light. And when it turned green, we would fucking drag race all the way down these empty streets. And I always remember the guy, soon as we got to the next whatever light, he would throw on his rollers and keep hauling down the street because it would look like he was doing something
other than drag racing
in the middle of the fucking night in Culver City.
For people outside the area of LA, that is impossible to imagine now. Culver City has transitioned into this little Hollywood. Like, this is just crazy foot traffic everywhere.
Tons of nightlife.
Right. But back then it was a dead zone in the middle of the night. I'm trying to think. Could we ever find that man show bit?
I'm scrumming through. You've done it a couple of times.
So I know. I think it's called Frontier Dads what it was called.
Well, he looks for that. Speaking of a couple of times, David Arquette crashed Loveline and The Morning Show. I'm still waiting for the trifecta of the podcast.
Mm.
Remember Arquette like walked into The Morning Show?
Right. Right.
Unannounced. Like, he wasn't a guest. He was just fucking walked into the building.
Arquette is heavily featured in Kid 90.
Here we go.
Yeah, the Arquette story for Loveline is he was being driven, I think, home from a Lakers game, which was at the Forum probably at the time. Mm. He's taken the 10 freeway, which is kind of going past the studio. And right about the time, would have made sense, probably about 10:30 at night, Lakers game was done. He's heading back to Malibu, living with Courtney Cox or something in Malibu at the time. And I was just talking, and they were listening to Loveline, back when everyone would just listen to one thing. You know, everyone was just, it's 10 o'clock, we'll listen to Loveline. And I was just telling Drew how insane he was and how nuts he is. And then Drew said, "Aren't you worried he's going to show up at the studio and kick your ass?" And I was like, "He's too nuts. He doesn't know where the studio
he
is.
Didn't find the studio.
He's insane. He can't find the studio." And then like 15 minutes later, just came walking through the door. And I don't mean the main door. I mean into the studio. That was a weird moment.
He did
moment.
The same thing in The Morning Show. It was amazing. That blew my mind the second time.
Was he cool about it, or was he
pissed? Totally in on the show. At least on The Morning Show.
But he was nuts, but had the navigation of a salmon. Like, he could find his spawning ground. You know what I mean?
Right.
There was a part of his brain that didn't process a lot of things, but another part that was dead nuts on in the directions department. Oh, do we have? Well, maybe it is a Brokeback Mountain precursor. Let's see.
Next, an inspiring struggle for pride and survival in the Old West. Dick Van Patten and LeVar Burton experienced firsthand the trials and tribulations of interracial gay adoption in the 1800s and pioneer dads. Oh. They work the land and each other.
Oh, yes, they do. I would rather take a bus full of hairdressers to see Snoopy on Ice than go to this dog. Next, from the makers of Forrest Gump, an ironic tale of one man's fight against fate. Robbie Benson plays a calligrapher whose world comes apart after he's stricken with carpal tunnel syndrome in Broken Quills.
Look at the cast.
This is one of my funnest times of the Man Show, is like sitting around trying to come out. Like, what if Robbie Benson had carpal tunnel, was a calligrapher? Yeah. So anyway, that's what earned the call from LeVar.
Nice.
The other thing is, during Corolla Classics, we were playing Albert Brooks, or Max Zapata and Gio was, from 2011 when I went to his office. And then after that, we're playing Judd Apatow. And they both had poignant things to say about the future. And I'll play the Albert Brooks clip. This is from 2011. This is from 10 years ago. It's kind of interesting because it was talking about the book 2031. So he's like had some ideas about what the future may bring. But this was his take on the future of entertainment from 2011.
If I could stay home, I would stay home versus perform.
By the way, look, you're heading towards that direction.
Yes,
look,
I am.
Look what you're able to do. This is almost staying home. You only drove 2 miles.
Yeah, no, that's my whole plan was to sort of stay home.
Absolutely, and I think that's a big future of show business. I'm amazed at how good Skype is getting, and I don't know why you or me or anyone that people would be interested in can't just have a cup of coffee and put on a nice shirt and turn on the Skype and have a show.
I agree.
Well, that is kind of what you see when you turn on the TV now, 10 years later.
Here we are.
Kind of wondering how much of it's going to go back. Hasn't saved the occasional technical glitch. Hasn't really bumped anybody. They're all just sort of Brady bunched up in those boxes. And then there was Judd Apatow.
Sorry to piggyback on your point. The only thing that you really... I really miss when I, well, not even miss, just notice when I watch like the TV, like you said, the boxes or live sports is the audience, you know, the applause, back from break, you know, that kind of stuff. Like that feels, I wouldn't say necessary, but it feels like it's missing.
Yeah, I agree. But it won't feel like it's missing to any young person that doesn't miss it. But and who grew up with this. Then there's Judd Apatow in 2015 talking about Dr. Seuss.
Lindbergh was a crazy anti-Semite. Walt Disney. We're
driving a Ford over there.
We're driving a Ford over there.
So Dr. Seuss, you see this terrible Dr. Seuss drawings from the beginning of his career. Apparently he drew all these like really racist caricatures of Japanese people and African Americans. They're auctioning one off that is so heinous. I can't even say what it is.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, now my curiosity. So he was talking about Seuss 6 years ago.
He knew.
Yeah. I'll tell you, guys like Apatow probably are on to what's offensive before it's offensive to the rest of us.
Yes. You know, and speaking of that, there was this awesome show on Sirius. I can't remember what comedy station it was on, but I wish I could give the person credit. But it was almost like a radio documentary about comics. And they had a great story about Judd Apatow meeting Steve Martin before Judd Apatow was famous when he was still a teenager. I don't know if he told you that story or not. But
I can't remember if it was in part two.
It was hysterical. He said... he's the biggest Steve Martin fan on the planet and everything. He ate, slept, and breathed Steve Martin. And he finally got to meet him and he asked for his autograph. And I guess Steve just wasn't really in the mood that day and kind of like brushed him off. And so Judd Apatow wrote to him apparently and said, if you don't send me an autograph, I'm going to tell every, tour bus around Hollywood exactly where your house is. And I know you don't want me to do that. So Steve Martin saw it apparently and sent an autograph back. And remember, this is when Judd Apatow's a kid. Nobody knows who he is, teenager. And he wrote back, excuse me, my apologies. I didn't know you were the Judd Apatow. Wouldn't that be a great letter to have from Steve Martin before you were famous?
Absolutely.
That would be. I had a friend who mailed. This is when he was a kid, late 80s. He would mail letters. I remember he had one framed on his wall. As an adult, he mailed one to Johnny Carson. He would mail them to all sorts of celebrities. He was a free thinker. And it said, like, hey, if you sign below, if I'm your best friend. And he sent it back, like, signed. And he has, like, a framed picture from Johnny, or a framed letter from Johnny Carson that he wrote and Johnny Carson signed that says, like, hey, this guy, his name is Adam. Adam is my best friend, Johnny Carson.
I got one of those. When I was with the Acme Theater, somebody from Jamaica, Queens, sent a letter to the Acme Theater because we were featured, or I was featured, or something in like the LA Weekly. And this guy would find all that stuff and get the autographs of people who were nobodies. I mean, obviously, I was a nobody back then. I was at Acme. No one had heard of me or anything. And it was like a preemptive strike.
Was he investing in up-and-comers?
Mart. Yeah, that's like domain names.
I don't know who this person was, but I found out later that he got several. It all came from Jamaica, Queens. I remember remembering that. And he would probably get all the L.A. papers and drama logs and varieties and stuff. And if somebody was featured, some young up-and-coming something, he would get their autograph. Although he could just do it, I'd sign a bottle of Mangree and send it out to him tomorrow. Now he didn't have to do a preemptive strike. All right, Pete Holmes, one of our favorites, is ready. We'll talk to him in a second. Quick break. Right back with Pete Holmes. Right after this.
The Adam Carolla Show presents Pete Holmes' birthday cocktail party for March 30th. Let's see who's on the guest list. The 17th century inventor of farm implements and the namesake of the greatest band with the flute, Jethro Tull. The guy who invented the Bunsen burner, Robert Bunsen. Vincent Van Gogh is here. Please lend him an ear. American blues musician, Sonny Boy Williamson. We welcome Warren Beatty, MC Hammer, Celine Dion, Piers Morgan, Nora Jones, the NFL's Richard Sherman, and slow hand Eric Clapton. Pete Holmes is on the Adam Carolla Show.
Yeah, Pete Holmes. Good to see you, my friend.
Just a list of better guests. We could have Clapton. We could have, I don't know.
Van Gogh.
Nora Jones.
Yeah, why'd we pick Pete Holmes out of all the birthdays? That's not how it works. Okay.
He's the only one available. Only March 30th available. I apologize.
Podcast, You Made It Weird with Pete Holmes, available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify as well. And, of course, the creator and star of one of my favorite shows from HBO, Crashing, which is I always talk to you about it because I'm very sad that show went away. I know it's been a couple years now, but I never know, and I guess I ask you this every time, is there a reason why a show like that goes away, or is that the lifespan of the show, two seasons or three seasons?
I mean, it sounds like I'm dodging it. Like I want to be like, it's money, but that's not an excuse. It was an expensive show. We shot on film. Our producer and director for a lot of episodes was Judd Apatow. I'm not saying he like insisted on a huge fee, but he gets a big fee, and film is very expensive and shooting in New York is expensive. So when you have a show that is watched by like a lot of really cool people, like you watch it and a lot of showbiz people like it, a lot of critics liked it, but it wasn't, it never crossed over. Like my mom's friends don't watch it. You know what I'm saying? Like it never had that like mass appeal. And if you don't have mass appeal, and again, I don't want to sound like I'm trying to make excuses, fewer people watch it and then they just can't justify it. So that's what the head of HBO told me. And frankly, I believed him. I was like, yeah, everybody's pulling in more money than they're making.
Yeah. But I guess philosophically, it's best to do a short run how you wanted to do it. Shot on film, the look was great. Shot in New York was great.
Yeah,
it was such a well-produced and directed and written show. And Pete Holmes was really good as acting in it. That you have the version of it that you want, and then what's the difference between 22 of those and 122 in the version that you didn't like?
Right. That's right. I think the answer is like $50 million. But yeah, you're absolutely right. And dude, like I'm not just saying this, but one of the things I'm so proud of about the show is that it was reflective of what it's really like to be a comedian, meaning your goals are small. I didn't want to have a show where it was like, I want to be on The Tonight Show. I want to be on Conan. Like, you don't really do that until you've done it for 10 years. And my character's at the 3-year mark. So, like, his goal, he starts the series wanting to be a comedian. He ends the series, he's a comedian. That's the achievement. And had we done a season 4, again, I guess I'm worried this sounds like I'm bullshitting. But if we had done a season 4, we would have had to done something splashy. We were sort of out of ideas. So it would have been like my life. I would have gotten a talk show from Conan or something like that. And that's where we would have lost 99% of our people, of comedians, would no longer relate. So I'm kind of proud that it was 3 seasons, because that is the experience of many musicians.
But maybe it would have attracted your mom's friends to season 4. And, you know, those finicky comedians, they come and go, and they're small in numbers. But your mom's friends, that's half the country.
That's the money demo, Adam. Money demo.
That's my problem, is I was making a show that other comedians would enjoy. I know there's millions of us, but not enough to float our budget, for sure.
Well, here's an interesting philosophical thing that just sort of reminded me of it when you were talking about making it, so to speak. It's so interesting, and Pete, I'll look for a story from you, and Gina and Brian may have a version themselves. When you're coming up, the stuff that's small seems really big at the time, and like as I think about it, I definitely told more people when I got a job teaching comedy traffic school at Let Us Amuse You Traffic Schools. Spelled like a head of lettuce, which is not funny.
But it's for vegans only. Vegan comedians,
I was probably more excited about not working as a carpenter, but working as a comedy traffic instructor for $89 a class than when I got on Letterman for the first time. I'm sure I told less people about being on Letterman than I did working for Let Us Amuse You.
The biggest break and the best part of being a comedian and the biggest break is when you lose your straight job. That's the best part. It doesn't get any better than that. And then people complain in my family that I don't tell them about things I'm doing and stuff. But at a certain point, you're just like, yeah, I'm doing stuff. But like the big announcement was I got the fuck out of Bennigan's. Like that was a really big deal. And that was actually the story that came to mind was I was so lucky when I started my stand-up career, when people asked me to open for them or when clubs asked me to open for them. It was the first time it was Jim Gaffigan, and it was a New Year's Eve weekend at the Cleveland Improv. And I thought I was going to get fired. I had to tell Bennigan's, because you had to work, I think it was like 3 out of the 4 holidays, Christmas, Thanksgiving, Christmas Eve, New Year's Eve, whatever it was. You had to work 3 out of those. And I had to tell them that I wasn't available on New Year's because I was opening for Jim Gaffigan, who, believe it or not, at the time, nobody knew who Jim Gaffigan was, but I did. I was a huge fan of his. And I thought I was going to get fired. And I went and saw The Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers. I still have the ticket stub, because the whole movie, all the orcs just represented my income. Like, they represented, you're going to lose your job. You're making like $100 to open for Jim Gaffigan. You're throwing away your family's stability. You're ending it all. So the Eye of Sauron was the Eye of Bennigan's. It was going to eat my soul. I ended up doing the weekend. They didn't fire me, which was great. But I also remember, dude, being so nervous before those shows. I'd wake up at 7 a.m. terrified that it was 7 p.m. and that I was late. Like, you're living in this like incredible heightened state of increased anxiety and fear. And then the weekend was fine. Jim liked me. I didn't kill, but Jim liked me. And then we ended up staying in touch. And then the second time I opened for somebody was Bill Burr. I had the best luck when it came. And again, Bill Burr was Billy Burr. People didn't know who Bill Burr was. And I was opening for him and forging these relationships. And it was just incredible, incredible luck. But going straight, nothing better than losing your straight job, I mean.
Yeah, that was the big significance. For me, I was a carpenter during the week still, but I taught the weekend classes at Let Us Amuse You. And just the fact that I was getting paid not to do something I formerly did, you know, when you work at Bennigan's or you work carpentry, you get paid to bus dishes or refill soda jerk or whatever the hell you're doing, swinging a hammer. The idea that you could stand and get paid and talk and get paid, that was a revelation.
Oh, it was the best. And, you know, I did both for a long time, too. I was dropping country chicken salads on people's laps on Monday and Tuesday. And I could work the lunch shift because it was in the Loop. It was downtown Chicago right by the Art Institute. It's a Walgreens now. But I remember they had a new network. I don't know how many in your career, Adam, you've seen where they're launching some new network. And this was called Stand Up Comedy TV, or they called it SCTV. And I was like, SCTV is taken. It's already a thing.
It's a very famous thing.
So that was a huge red flag that it was also called SCTV. But my friend Emily DeRizis, they got her involved in booking it, and they booked me. And then they made this reel, and it was like me and Dave Coulier, I remember. But they used a big portion of my bit in the reel, so they asked me to come by their office. And I remember the CEO of this now defunct network that never was a thing, but he was like, so what do you do? And I was like, I didn't know any show business. I was like, well, I'm a waiter. I work Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Then every once in a while, I go out for a weekend. And he flipped out. I wasn't there. But my friend Emily, who was also a comedian, I could hear him yelling at her through the wall, like, this fucking guy's a waiter. You brought me waiters. And I was like, what do you think? You know, some pirates also picked up a few shifts when they weren't on the seven seas. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's a good point. This can't be new. There had to be guys out who were, like pirates. And
you can't be swashbuckling all the time.
Gail Sayers bagged groceries, I'm sure, in the off season.
The weather's bad.
Yes.
We're gonna be hanging at our port of call for a while, and you need some walking around money. You need some wham. Yeah,
people did not understand that. And then Emily very sweetly was like, when you're here, just lie. Like, that was sort of my first showbiz lesson, I suppose, was when you're here, just tell everybody it's like hip hop. Like, my friend John Roy used to have a joke about no rappers rap about, like, before they were rich. You have to just pretend you're rich on your first album, even though you're not. It's a great bit.
It's so funny because Let Us Amuse You had that exact same lying to the audience policy.
Yeah.
Which was, I remember you guys, like, remember having those sort of lucid thoughts and the insane thing that you call your former life, you know? And I was sitting there in the Let Us Amuse You headquarters in Burbank with all the other struggling comedian actor hosts who were the teachers, you know? And the head instructor guy was like, look, people can go to Sears for $19. They can do the Sears Traffic School for $19. Let Us Amuse You charges $29. So they're paying a premium. And they're not paying a premium for struggling comics who aren't established. So go ahead,
start each class by building yourself up. You know, to lay out your resume and don't be scared to embellish.
It's the same with life coaches. Life coaches can't be like, this is my first week. Right. Honestly, I could use some help. Doing. You got to believe in yourself. They have to.
And I always remember I was sitting in the class and I used to teach Sunday mornings at like 8 a.m. and it'd be at like a YMCA in Conejo or Whittier Narrows, or they're always out of town because I was the new guy, so I had to drive, right? So I remember thinking, I'm there in at a Holiday Inn, and it's 7:45 Sunday morning, and I got a clip-on tie on. Should I say I just opened for Rod Stewart? Should I say I just got off the road with the Rolling Stones? Like, what story could I tell me? I just sold out the Improv three nights. Like, why would I be in Conejo at 7:45 on a Sunday morning?
I love cones.
If this career was going well, why would I be here?
Yeah, that's right. I remember when I left Bennigan's, the manager said to me, his name was Rob, the general manager of one of the most popular Bennigan's in the company's history. So he was a big deal. And I told him I was leaving, and he just with dead eyes, he just goes, New York or LA. He didn't even know I was a comedian. Just everybody there was trying to do something, like was trying to do something in show business, most likely.
Well, that's another interesting subject, which is if you work at a Bennigan's, you are trying to have a career in something other than working at Bennigan's. And if you work at Let Us Amuse You Comedy Traffic School, you're trying to do something, showbiz, stand up or write or something comedically. But if you have a job like Carpenter, those guys weren't trying to do anything other than get through their divorce and keep their jet skis. That was their thing. It's like, I got to get through this fucking divorce and keep the jet ski. Like, then no one, it's interesting. Jobs like carpentry, the only movement is like, I got the Ford F-150. I'm going to get the F-250 with the crew cab next year. It was just a different version of what they were doing. But nobody said, I've got to dance.
Something about the rhythm of these hammering nails. I just got to move. It's funny. There's no Let Us Amuse You comedy traffic school lifers. Nobody's doing that. Like, this is it. I'm in. But some people do want to just be in that waiter life because it's sort of like being a comedian. You work weird hours. There's a lot of drinking.
Cash tips.
Yeah, exactly. You'd always enter your tips at the end of the day and just try and hit the lowest number you could hit.
But
working on Rodeo, I knew many career retailers and they drove way better cars than I've ever driven and they looked the part and it just, I didn't get it, but I respected it.
Yeah. But maybe if you're 28 and you're working at Bennigan's and you're talking about making a career out of being a waiter, we should take you to Musso Frank or we should take you to Dupar's as a scared straight type field trip. Like, honey, how old are you? I'm Bernice. I'm 83 years young. All right. Tell this person why you don't want to argue with people over pie when you should be enjoying your grandchildren.
The ghost of Christmas future.
That's right. Like, just see, this is going to be, you're going to have a huge brooch.
Yeah.
Terrible dye job.
Yes, terrible dye job. You're going to run it. You're going to call people hun endlessly throughout the day.
What that for you, hun?
Yeah.
And you won't know why that's weird. They think it's normal to call people hun because they've been in a restaurant for too long.
Were you a waiter at Bennigan's?
I was, and they called me Moose because I'm enormous. And I was a good waiter. I sort of had a weird trajectory at Bennigan's. My first month there, I was the employee of the month because I was so happy to have a job. I'd just gotten married. This was my first marriage when I was 22. I moved to Chicago. 9/11 had just happened. So, like, it was hard to get a job for a beat there. And then I got lucky and got this job at Bennigan's, and I was so happy to be there. I bet you were that way too, Adam. Like, I had a really good work ethic, and nobody else there seemed to give a shit.
Yeah.
So my first month, I was employee of the month and everybody loved Moose. But by the end, I was really phoning it in because I saw how little effort you really had to give it. And I was abusing the coupon system and running different scams. Everybody was scamming. Anytime there was a promotion in the Sun Times or something, the waiters were all making a hustle off of that. And we did that. Did you do hustles, Brian?
There's nothing better than a low-level scam at a job like that. Like, my first job was awesome. a grocery store bagger. And like you, Pete, like, you get this sort of pride in, like, oh, I do this one thing really well. I bag groceries well. And the scam that we had, I mean, he's like, oh, this bag of chips just broke open. Oh, God, because someone's got to eat it. Can't throw it away.
Yeah.
All I had to do was like, oh, the box cutter cut this box of crackers. Oh, I've got to eat it.
We had that. We'd order ourselves birthday pie because you could order the brownie bottom sundae for free. And we also, like, my favorite scam was when the Chicago Marathon was happening. If you got that terrible shift, which was like 7 a.m. on the morning of the marathon, everybody came into Bennington's just to get a coffee. And you'd keep, this is crooked. I'm not proud of it. But you'd keep one receipt for a coffee that said, like, the coffee was $3 or something. And then you just show that to everybody. Everybody's just giving you $5 cash. But the attitude wasn't to just be like a sneaky Pete. The attitude was like, fuck you for making me work the shift. Yeah. No one's eating. I'm getting no tables. Everyone's just coming in and taking coffee.
You're taking your pound of flesh.
And you make, what, $15? Like, it sucked. Like, it's still, even doing it crooked, you'd still make like $30, $40 a shift. Something had to give. No wonder I was happy to upgrade to MC and make $50 a night. I mean, that was an improvement.
There was no scam in the Let Us Amuse You comedy traffic school galaxy. But I'll tell you what the only scam was anyone who showed up just wanted you to sign a certificate and hand it to them so they could take it to the courthouse. They didn't want to be there 8 hours, and I didn't want to be there 8 hours either. So there was a scam at the beginning where everyone just come in, everyone just sign everything, hand it back, and just everyone leaves. And again, it's like, be like ripping off a drug dealer. You think they're going to go to the cops? You know, like,
yeah.
That was the revelation, was realizing the managers didn't give a shit either. Like, you think, oh, it's your manager. What, is he 25? Like,
right.
He's another guy. I mean, I'd love to know how much of the corporate infrastructure of TGI Fridays is allotted to just, like, there's going to be some shenanigans. Because there were scams that I wasn't doing, but people would delete whole bills and stuff. You get stiffed all the time, and sometimes a nice manager would delete stuff off their bill, so you at least made a little bit of money. I still remember. I'm trying to remember his name. He's not listening.
I did think Matt
Neary was my manager. I'm sorry to interrupt, Gina.
Yeah.
Matt Neary was my manager when I asked for that New Year's Eve off, and I thanked him on my first record, which he has no idea. But I thought I was so grateful that he didn't fire me, because if he said, if you do that gig, I'm going to fire you, I probably wouldn't have done the gig. And Jim Gaffigan ended up working with me a bunch, so it was a big deal.
At Bennington's, or was Jim doing?
At Bennington's, yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah, okay.
I can't even get in touch. I miss that kid that was so nervous to just go, like, I'm sorry, I need New Year's Eve off. Like, they have 1,000 waiters. It's not a big deal. Like, people were no call, no showing all the time, and I was just asking for an extra day off. Who gives a shit? But I really thought it mattered. I didn't want to be a bad kid.
Gina?
I want to know if you ever pulled this, though I know you're a very nice guy and you would never have done this, but a little PSA, because I have friends who were waiters in LA, and that's why I always take my receipt with me when I leave a restaurant, because friends who didn't think that you tipped enough would take the merchant and customer receipt and just scribble in a new tip.
Yeah, what are they going to do? I still do that. That is a good tip, Gina. Yeah, unfortunately, I never did that. But you could think about it. Somebody's getting their credit card bill. Are they going to remember that it was $23 or $28? They're not going to remember. So, like, some people, if you don't leave the receipt, like, you should take your copy of the receipt if you want to prove it. The other thing was a double grad. I don't know if you remember what a double grad.
The double drop.
Well, we call it a double grad. Yeah. So if a table of five or more, there's automatically a 18% tip on there. I would, there were two moves with the double grat. So it's an automatic gratuity.
Right.
One is if they look like they're having a lively conversation and it's going on an expense account and they don't give a shit, just drop the bill subtly while they're having a nice laugh. They'll just put a credit card on it. You take it. They're not going to notice. I know this is not great. I'm not proud of this. I feel conflicted as I'm saying this, but I also don't feel conflicted because I double grat. I see the gratuities on there and I'll still tip on top of it because come on, it's a hard job. But if you get a very distinct sense that they are going to look at it, which is most people, I had this whole spiel where I'd go, just to let you guys know, and I played the, like, I'm a nice guy, I'm telling you. Mm-hmm. There is an 18% gratuity already on there. It does go on before the tax, so it's a little bit less than 18%. This is literally, I can't believe I remember it. It's like the words to the birthday song. I go, so you don't have to tip over it. Of course, I'd appreciate it if you did, but it's up to you. That's what I would say, and they always would.
You have to after that.
If somebody goes, like, it's really, it's more like 15%, or 10%, like if you could help me out. But I mean, you got stiffed. I remember this is one thing I'll never forget. I had a lot of bits about being a waiter, but I always think of this one kid who ordered a water. And I said, do you want a bottle water? And he was like on a date. And he said, no, I want tap water. And then he said to his date, I didn't do this on stage. He said to his date, when I drink water, I want to taste it. So he was like appreciating the notes of chlorine,
the water purist,
and iron, and like all the and fluoride and all these things. He's like, that's water. That's water to me. Don't take that stuff out. That's extra stuff.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. The bar is insanely low for waiters. If you think about it, because I can't tell you the amount of times I've been out to dinner and I'm paying, and at some point when it's time to do the tip, the person next to you goes, she was really nice. Like, she was good. She was nice. Or he was nice. And you always get sucked in. Like, yeah, they were really nice. And give them a big tip. But it's not like they called you a racial epithet and beat off into your Caesar salad or something. I mean, part of their job is kind of showing up and being semi-friendly.
It's an act. It's I was like the kid in Office Space. Remember the guy's like, you want some jalapeno poppers? And I was like that guy. So I put on a little show, but I did make mistakes all the time. I remember these two women came in and they got the baked potato soup, which was like Bennigan's standard. And I brought it out and it was really thick. It had started to like congeal. It's pretty disgusting, but it was like an old soup. And they showed it to me, and they were like, it's so thick. And I still remember this because I went, well, that's just how it comes out sometimes. And I just left. And then they wrote on the receipt. They gave me no tip, and they wrote on the receipt verbatim. I remember it because it went right on my heart. Your reaction over the soup left much to be desired.
Wow.
And I was like, that will hurt. And I still remember it. It still bothers me. So I looked at them as like little sets. It's like little crowds of two or five people trying to get a few laughs. Some people hated me. I remember I would check in on tables a lot. And somebody was like, it was a young guy, but he was like, you've asked us if we're okay like five times.
You're welcome.
Like, I was like, yeah, after every course, I'm asking, is the appetizer okay? Is the entree okay? Is the dessert okay? And he's like, leave us the fuck alone. I'm like, I'm sorry, I'm giving you a little bit more attention than Arby's. Like, this is an Arby's.
Hey, where do you guys come down on this? Because it happened to me last night. I went out to dinner. I try to do the low-carb thing. But the thing about the low-carb thing is, I'm a weak person, but I'll try to do the low carb thing. The thing about the low carbs is you can order the low carb thing. You can go, give me a steak and give me some broccolini and I'll do the salad, but don't do me the rice peel off. You know, you can kind of control it, but some places do the rolls. They do the pre-dinner rolls. Off a lot of places do the pre-dinner rolls, and the pre-dinner roll is not delivered by the waiter or the waitress, and it's never discussed. you're just sitting there talking, and next thing you know, a roll comes in and lands in the middle of the table, and then you look up, and there's a guy who's struggling with the language, and he's walking away.
He's gone.
He's gone. Yeah. So he's dropped the roll off, and to me, all right, act of God, now we have to eat the rolls. Yeah. They dropped off the whipped butter and the rolls. So fuck it, we're going to eat it. So I'm like, I'm not going to sit here and stare at this roll while the butter melts. I said no carb, but he dropped the rolls off. Manna from heaven, force majeure, we're eating the rolls. So
why not eat the rolls?
Because
Adam?
Most alcoholics might put together a few days of sobriety, but what if you force them to sit in a bar and watch a Lakers game? You know
put
what I mean?
Whiskey in front of them.
Put a whiskey in front of them. Right.
What are they to do?
There's lots of alcoholics that don't drink. If you could put a whiskey down and then say, you know, I didn't order this. You just want rolls. You're a fat piece of shit and you love rolls.
I did not order the rolls.
You're pulling in the language barrier. You couldn't say no thank you. It understands.
These Guatemalans and their fucking rolls. I'm sorry.
Why make it a racial issue?
I believe it's part of a bigger issue, Pete. I don't want to get into politics. We can move forward. But here,
Pete knows the rolls and the bread are very often recycled, the untouched, you know, rolls and bread. So,
the chips and salsa.
Here's the problem. Devour. Oh, not the chips. Okay. I want to get into that.
That's carbs,
I devour baby. The roll. I devour the roll. This was last night. Then, 10 minutes later, from over my shoulder, I'm not facing the person, over my shoulder comes a second roll. It's dropped down the table. Then I say, oh, no, I don't want the roll. And the guy goes, I can't take it back. And I said, just take the roll back. You did it with the tongs. Like, I can't put it back in the thing. And I was like, wait a minute. Now this is the roll's my problem. You threw another roll at me. This is the second. It's the second roll. So I started on the second. I picked the roll up and moved it to the other side of the table because he wouldn't take it back. Now my thing is that's on you, buddy. Then take the fucking roll and chuck it into the bushes. Then if you can't.
When he dropped it, did he say sorry? This is how we roll. I'm sorry. I gotta go. I do this too. I play food games where you go like this roll. It's gonna get wasted. I have to eat this roll now. Sometimes my wife will order a dessert and she's like, I don't want to eat this whole thing. And I come in like a hero. I'm like, I'll dive on this grenade.
Right.
It's like, really, you can just let the creme brulee go. Like, throw it away. It's fine. You don't have to put it into your body. But you feel like you have
to. I can't from how I grew up. I can't do it.
Yeah, I understand. It's part of your background. I think about you all the time because I walk my dog. I pick up my dog's poop and I'll put it in anybody's garbage can. And I always hear your voice go, I don't want to smell someone else's dog shit when I open up my can. And I was like, really? Really? Who's opening up the can and taking a deep whiff like a pot of soup?
And
you're rolling them out.
Even if you did, Peter, I promise you, we could do a blind test all
Yes,
day,
yes.
You would never be able to definitively say that trash can has a tied up bag of dog poop in it.
Especially if you have a dog, you'd be like, there is dog shit, but it's not my dog.
Wait a second. Now, hold on. My policy is if the can's on the way out, like it's still full, you can throw it at the top. If it's been emptied, then the homeowner has to just retrieve their trash can with your dog's shit. And the first thing in that sacred ground known as one's trash can is your dog's shit. That my thing is not that you can't do it, but you can't do it if it's been emptied because now they're bringing it back up their driveway.
But now it's on the bottom. Now you're a good 6 feet away from that little bag of doggy doo-doo. I could say, okay, if we put it on the top and it's full and they come back, they have a banana that they want to add. Aren't they getting the same olfactory penalty?
Yeah, this is more symbolic than it really is anything. Don't get me wrong. I'm not lumping you guys in with the guys who shot Lady Gaga's dog walker as part of a gang initiation. It's not as bad.
Is that a thing?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Not as bad as that. I still feel like there's a marginal practical side to it, but it's more of a symbolism. This person has to pull the trash cans back up their driveway with the poop in it. Now
you
look,
should have little business cards that you hand out, Adam, that say, "I don't really care as much as I seem to care about what I'm saying."
That's right.
It's just sort of my thing.
Symbolic.
Yeah, symbolic.
It's symbolic.
It's symbolic.
You can drop it on outdoor restaurant tables, like someone who drops a card saying, "Will you buy this? I'm hard of hearing."
Yes.
That guy.
When did those people get? When did they leave the airport? And did they say, 9/11. Okay, deaf people who sell globe keychains, you're out. TMZ, you're in.
Right,
come on now.
Right.
We've been waiting out there for a while. Like, I feel like there is no more Hare Krishnas or deaf
Hare
people.
Krishna.
The Hare Krishnas moved to the 3rd Street Promenade.
Oh, really?
They party hard on weekends. Oh, my God. They fill up the whole promenade. That's where they went. They went to Santa Monica.
Interesting.
It's not deaf people, isn't it? Mute people.
Well, it's mute.
Oh, yeah. Is it mute?
It's mute people because they hand you the card,
the pencils,
right?
And pencils. Yeah. Oh. You never know what my policy. I wonder what your policy is, Adam. I have a feeling it's different. My policy is: I'm on the subway. Kid's selling candy for his basketball team. My policy is: who cares if it's true or not? The kid's selling candy. Here's $5 for some candy. Adam Carolla, sound off. Let's get weird.
I'm generally that way as well. What I've been duped into in the past is buying magazine subscriptions from that guy's older brother. And Not Popular Mechanics, Penthouse, Hustler, Jugs, Double D's, all the stuff. It never arrived. It's never arrived. So I do believe that's a straight one-on-one, you know, victimless crime kind of transaction. You want to sell me the bar? I'll buy it.
In New York, you see some honest kids doing it now that go, this isn't for our basketball team. We're just selling candy. Because it's funny, people will not do it because they don't want to be duped. But if they just say, that's just capitalism. They're just saying, I bought bulk candy bars, I marked it up, and now I'd like to make a profit. Anybody can be in on that.
Well, that's also a lot of panhandling here in LA. There's a lot more cardboard signage that says, like, needs money for weed and beer.
Yeah,
right.
And
you want to
reward that guy.
The honesty angle.
Yeah.
That's right. I see more and more of that. We're in a post era of panhandle. No more pans. I've never seen him handle a pan. Where's the pan?
why is the basketball team candy always candy you've never heard of?
Yeah, I know what you mean. Jumbo pop. There's a jumbo?
I don't want to return it to race, but is basketball a little on the nose? Like, pick soccer. You pick water polo, and I'm in now, because that seems very bizarre and authentic now. Specific.
Is it brilliant? Or is it brilliant? You want to be on the nose. Your market is like little old ladies from the Midwest. You're a kid from Brooklyn. You go, like, what do they think I'm up to? Probably basketball. Hey, we need jerseys for our bat. And she goes, that sounds right. Like, that's who they're going for.
But when you see a Pete Holmes type, it's time to mix it up. You know, tell them.
I'm selling Bibles.
I'm looking to play the harp.
You don't know how expensive it is to constantly be restringing a harp.
All right.
Please help me out. That's it.
All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back with Pete Holmes. We'll play Rotten Tomatoes right after this.
Ooh.